E. Rushton.
One of our most neglected symphonists.
It's music that speaks to the heart.
It's too profound, it's too deep.
In Malcolm Arnold's centenary year, Simon Heffer unearths his troubled world.
It's now widely known that he suffered greatly throughout his life from problems with his mental health.
He would disappear for days, he would be on benders. I don't know how he wrote a symphony then. I mean, he was in such a bad state.
He was a victim of his illness and our ignorance about mental illness.
Malcolm Arnold, the tortured composer. This evening at 6:45 on Radio 3... and BBC Sounds.
It's midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the neuroscientist Mark Solms.
Mark Solms is a neuroscientist who spent his whole career investigating the mysteries of consciousness. His research throws light on some of the most difficult questions of all. How does the mind connect to the body? Why does it feel like something to be you? Born in Namibia and educated in South Africa, he came to Britain in his late 20s to avoid military service under the apartheid regime. He made his name with research into what happens in the brain when we're dreaming. Then he startled his scientific colleagues by training as a psychoanalyst, something which, he says, put me at odds with the rest of my field. He's now very unusual in holding eminent positions within both psychoanalysis and scientific research. He's the author of 6 books and divides his time between London and Cape Town, where he also pursues his other career as a winemaker. Well, there's a lot to unpack there, Mark, and I'm not sure whether to start with wine or dreams or perhaps a combination of the two.
Yes, I too don't know where to start. You said I startled my colleagues when my neuroscientific colleagues when I decided to train as an analyst. What one of them actually said to me was, "You can't do that. That's like an astronomer training in astrology."
So let's begin with music. You've brought us a playlist which runs enterprisingly from Bach to Talking Heads, taking in Ligeti, Beethoven, Chopin. And I think you're trying to do something rather unusual for us. You're hoping to illustrate your scientific research through the music you've chosen, because it's all about feelings, isn't it?
That's right. I suppose all of music is all about feelings, but I've made this selection with that particularly in mind. Starting with Bach's fugue in C-sharp major from the Well-Tempered Clavier, and that phrase, I think, gets us right to the heart of the problem that my life's work has been all about. I mean, how can your piano have a mood? And this is what our brains somehow miraculously achieve, that we are sentient beings who feel something, but at the same time, we are an instrument, an apparatus, a physical machinery. And how these two things combine is what could be more interesting than that. It's like looking at a brain scan or looking at an EEG and seeing all the complexity that lies behind what might actually be something rather simple when experienced, which is, I think, what Bach pulls off here, something that is calming and beautiful, but behind which is an incredibly complex piece of engineering.
Peter Hill with the Prelude and Fugue in C-sharp major from the second book of The Well-Tempered Clavier by Johann Sebastian Bach. Can I take you back to the beginning, Mark Soms, and why you decided to become a doctor specialising in the brain? I think this was sparked, really, by a very traumatic event in your childhood when you were playing outside with your brother.
Yes, my brother was 6, I was 4 at the time. Our parents were yachting, as they often did. We were playing in the clubhouse. My brother clambered up onto the roof, tripped and fell 6 meters onto a concrete pavement below, fractured his skull, sustained a bleed in his brain, required emergency surgery, survived, thank God. But the brain being what it is, as I learnt on that fateful day, when my brother came back, he looked the same, but he wasn't the same. And that must be why I became interested, not only in the brain, but also in the relationship between the brain and the mind. How can it be that, where's my brother gone to? Who's this guy? And the shock of it, it was an uncanny, very distressing and disturbing experience.
Mm-hmm. This event, I think, put you into quite a deep depression, didn't it?
It did. I think that at one level, it's just I missed my brother. He was. We lived in a small village, and we remained rather aloof from the other villagers for all sorts of complicated reasons. So my brother was very much my best friend, and so I lost him in that ordinary way. The thought that I came to, and again, I want to repeat that I think we underestimate what sorts of things children think about. But the thought that I came to was, what's the point of doing anything? If I am just my body and my body is a mortal thing and it's going to disappear, then what is the point of, whatever I've achieved, it's all, from my point of view, going to come to nothing. And, no matter how much I might enjoy my life, it's a finite thing. And that enjoyment, once gone, is gone and gone forever. So it was a sort of nihilistic despair that overcame me. And, just so that our listeners know what we're talking about, I remember literally not being able to summon the energy to put my shoes and socks on in the morning to go to school. It just seemed like too much effort and something that was not worth doing.
Is there possibly an element of guilt here that you survived and that to a certain extent you've alleviated that by helping others with brain injuries?
Well, you should be a psychoanalyst, Michael, because that is exactly correct. But it took me years to work that out in retrospect. The guilt that you refer to wasn't so much that I survived as that I was cleverer than my brother. Things came easily to me academically. For him, everything was a struggle. And so, you feel proud of your achievements at school. But in my case, every time I did well, it was a source of pain. The solution to that conflict was, if I study neuroscience, and in particular, if I'm a clinician in this area helping people like my brother, then I can do well without feeling bad about it.
We began with a Prelude and Fugue by Bach, and we're now moving forward over 2 centuries to Ligeti and his Musica Ricercata, or Researched Music, a set of 11 pieces.
Yes, I chose numbers 6 and 11, and I chose them very much with the Bach Prelude and Fugue in mind that we listened to earlier. And as you say, it's 200 years later, where Bach is the sort of culmination of fugal music. It's a sort of absolute mastery. One cannot do it better than that. And then along comes Ligeti and does something entirely reinvents everything.
What I loved about those two pieces and the way they contrasted was, in the first, it was almost as though Ligeti was clowning around, having fun, bit of humour with the rests in between phrases. And then he said, I'm going to put on my serious hat now and write something based on 12-tone music.
Yeah, I'm not a pianist, but I should imagine whoever first looked on this score must have thought, but this is impossible. You know, how can you play this?
Pierre-Laurent Aymard, with music from Ligeti's Musica Ricercata. And by the way, details of the music choices of my guest today, Mark Soms, can be found on Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download a whole library of past programmes. We were talking just now, Mark Soms, about why you started working with people with brain injuries. And when you did, you became very interested in asking them about their dreams. So what did you find out?
I asked them about their dreams because the only topic to do with consciousness that was legitimate, that was mainstream those days in the 1980s, was sleep and waking. How does the brain put us to sleep? How does it wake us up in the morning? Dreams, of course, are the interesting part of sleep, because that's when consciousness punctuates this otherwise unconscious state. So I was asking my neurological patients, patients with damage to different parts of their brains, whether they dreamt or not, and if they did, you know, how their dreams might have been altered by their brain disease. And what I discovered was really serendipitous. I can't claim any great scientific talent for having accidentally stumbled upon this finding, which is that the patients who reported that they no longer dreamt, they had damage in a different part of the brain from the part of the brain that generates REM sleep. And REM sleep we had taken to be the physiological basis of dreaming. So patients with damage to the part that generates REM sleep, they continue to dream. And those who stopped dreaming had damage in a quite different brain area. And that shows what price we pay for ignoring the subjective side of the mind-body equation. If you don't talk to your patients about their experience, the objective data give you the impression that they've lost a function, in this case REM sleep, but the subjective data is needed for you to ascertain whether they are actually dreaming or not. And so that's how I made that happy discovery.
Of course, you can talk to your patients about their dreams and try and interpret them, but thanks to scanning machines, you can also see where the brain activity is actually happening during dream time, can't you?
That's the whole benefit of being alive at this point in scientific history, is that when you mentioned that I'm a psychoanalyst and I studied psychoanalysis in order to try and bring more of the subjective side of things into neuroscience, as I said, I felt that was frustratingly lacking in the 1980s. But what was lacking in Freud's time and what's lacking in psychoanalysis is that objective, measurable, quantifiable, physiological certainty. And for me, it's a kind of the obvious thing to do is not to look at it from the one perspective or the other. Why not both? And I had learned, as we all did in the sciences, that Freud was a bit of a speculative guy. You know, we don't take him too seriously. The methods that he used were entirely subjective psychological methods and so on. But it turned out that, you know, he was onto something. Dreams are motivated, emotionally driven states. And so it was because of my finding that dreams are not driven by the motivationally neutral part of the brain that generates REM sleep, but rather by these structures of the kind that Freud would have imagined, that made me take a second look at Freud. And I told my colleagues, perhaps we owe him an apology.
And their reaction to that?
Well, I have to say that it hasn't gone swimmingly. Freud is an extremely controversial figure in the sciences, and I find it hard to understand. Of course, Freud he got a lot wrong. I mean, he was a pioneer, as Newton was or Darwin was. You know, but, you know, we don't say that these founding figures of physics and biology, you know, were, you know, terrible frauds because, you know, they didn't know what we know now. I think that we should treat Freud in a similar sort of way, as somebody who sketched out the basic picture of how the mind works. And then we've filled in the details and, of course, corrected him on all sorts of points along the way.
You spent a lot of your time during the last 20 years, Mark, working on a new edition of Freud, haven't you? 24 volumes, I think, and translated a series of his early works too. So are you still finding truths there in Freud that are helpful to you now in your clinical work?
I am, and I see it rather as the history of music and how each composer builds upon what came before. And in this instance, the same applies. Well, in fact, it applies in all science. We're building upon what came before. And Freud, not many people realize, Freud was a neuroscientist. Freud published many neuroscientific papers over a period of 20 years before he became interested in psychology and developed the field of psychoanalysis. And it was only because the research methods were not available to him. He was interested, as I am, as we all probably are, in these big questions about how the brain and the mind relate to each other. But he couldn't study the brain side of things. So what I think I'm doing is really just finishing the job, doing what Freud was trying to do all those years ago, but with better tools. And so you speak of my work as a translator and editor of Freud. It began with me translating his neuroscientific works, which are not sufficiently well known because they're not available in English. And it was because I was doing that four-volume set when the publishers of his psychological works decided that there was a need for a revised edition. They roped me into doing that too. That's why it's taken 20 years, because altogether, so the psychological works are 24 volumes, the neuroscientific works are four volumes. It's a massive, massive piece of work.
I would like to indulge your desire to dream by playing next a piece that I know you love, which is a nocturne by Chopin. Why this?
Well, two aspects of what we've been talking about. The one is the relationship between music and affect, music and feeling. There's a sort of melancholy that's conveyed in this nocturne, and also something of the time of night that such music should be played. But there's also a reference back to Bach, a deep reference back to Bach. Chopin loved Bach and built, so again, what we were speaking about earlier of building upon what came before. Thank you.
Jan Liszewski playing Chopin's Nocturne in F-sharp major from a recording released earlier this year. We would not appreciate music were it not for the feelings, and the fact that we do appreciate music because of feelings means we're using our consciousness.
Exactly. So you referred to my theory of consciousness, and you used the word feeling there in its more general sense. You know, what it is like to be conscious is to feel something. But my view, which is not a philosophical view, but rather one grounded in research into the brain mechanisms of consciousness, is that it is in its most fundamental form feeling, in the affective sense of the word. In other words, valenced emotional feeling states are the basic form of consciousness, in my view.
As a doctor, Mark, you see people all the time whose brains are beginning to fail through disease or injury. How do their tangled thoughts help you discover more about those hard questions which I outlined at the beginning, the nature of consciousness itself?
If you listen to the thoughts of your neurological patients with the same ear as you listen to those of psychotherapy patients, in other words, take the meaning of what they're saying seriously rather than just the form of it, you learn all sorts of things. So, for example, I studied a condition called confabulatory amnesia, where the patient can't remember what happened from one moment to the next, and they don't realize that they don't remember. They think they do, and so they come up with all sorts of false memories. False in the sense that it didn't just happen a minute ago, but if you take the content seriously, you find, well, actually, these are memories. They're just mislocated in time and in place. They're things that happen to the patient in another context. If you then take the trouble to find out from their spouse or parents or children or whatever, you know, what that occasion was all about, you start to understand something of why they remember precisely what they do. So, for example, a patient of mine who had brain surgery and as a result of that operation to remove a tumor suffered this condition, told me he had just had an operation, but the operation in question was a dental operation where implants had been put into his jaws. And a few minutes later, he was saying he'd had an operation in which a cardiac pacemaker had been fitted. Now, what his family told me was he had had those operations years ago, and both of them had been successful. So what he was doing was remembering successful operations instead of this unsuccessful one, you know, which had had such tragic consequences. Now, that's just one tiny example. I found studying the confabulations of these patients, you know, in large numbers, that that's a general rule, that confabulations are wishful, that the patient remembers things which place them in a better position than they're actually in. And there I was led to the realization of the important role that feelings and motivations play in cognitive operations like memory. And in fact, in all of our lived experience, you know, we are not most of us are not neurologically diseased. But that same principle applies. You know, we try to recast things, our memories of events in a slightly more favorable light, and we try to forget those things which are sad and embarrassing.
This takes us to your next choice rather nicely, because it's a poem by your partner, Eliza Kentridge. It's from her 2015 book, Signs for an Exhibition. And it's about Eliza's late mother, Alicia, who got dementia, written from the viewpoint of the daughter, but with her mother's strange utterances interrupting it.
There's that waking from a dream, having found the thing one had lost. Like tonight. It was there, my lost glove, crushed in the wet road. I was so happy to retrieve it. Often you come to us in our dreams. You are better. You can walk, speak. We go to the opera. We embrace. Give me a hug. You've been gone so long. Sometimes you are rising from the table, from your table as you naturally did. Waking from the dreams of finding, I lie for a moment. Information gathers itself around me, shifting clumps of quicksilver, my body mantled with its phosphorescence, like a swimmer in a night sea. What does it mean? The meaning clears momentarily. It gathers to an image. The lost glove found, the sick one cured. A temporary truth. Then the crystals shift again. The lens refracts again. Washed again in the old knowledge. Glove still lost. You afflicted still.
Eliza Kentridge reading from a poem about her mother from Signs for an Exhibition. I'm very aware, Mark Soms, that I've only really scratched the surface of your extraordinary research into consciousness. But I do want to hear about your other passion, winemaking. Your family's had a farm in South Africa since, I think, the 17th century. But looking back at your family history, you began to discover some rather painful truths, didn't you?
I'm not sure which of the many painful truths you have in mind. Perhaps you should tell me what you've uncovered.
Well, I think the legacy of slavery and the suffering that caused.
Okay. Yes. I hasten to add that as far as that's concerned, my family is not unique. I think that... So my farm, which is in Franschhoek, in South Africa, just outside Cape Town. Franschhoek refers to, it's the French Quarter, it's where the Huguenots were settled in the 17th century. You know, I researched the history of my farm and what my forebears did, and it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. The land that I now live on, it was occupied by the indigenous people of the Cape. I know that because I brought archaeologists in to dig the place up. And so, you know, all the beauty and everything that we produce there, all of its value, we must remember starts with the dispossession of the indigenous people who, you know, they were hunter-gatherers who didn't even believe in private land ownership. So you can imagine what a catastrophe it was for them when we staked out that beautiful piece of land and said, you know, we think we'll plant vineyards here. And then, you know, there's a further wave of horror, which is that in order to work those vineyards and produce the wine, they brought slaves. In the case of my farm, like all the other farms around it and all the other families around it, you know, they brought slaves from the east, from India, Indonesia, from the east coast of Africa. And so my beautiful manor house where I live with my children's bedrooms, you know, it's all so exquisite and luxurious, but it was literally built by slaves. My whole farm was built on the back of these sorts of horrors. And then comes apartheid, as if it were just a detail, on top of all of that. So it's very important for us to remember. And I say again, it's not just my family or my farm. All of the old families in the Cape, all of those farms, we have to remember at what cost we are where we are today. And we have to also, more than that, try to make amends for that history.
But you have done that, haven't you? Because the vineyard is now owned or partially owned by the workers.
Well, it was, you know, when I first went back to South Africa, as you mentioned in the introduction, I left in the 1980s because those days young white men were conscripted into the South African army. But then there were all these miraculous changes that none of us foresaw. And so I went back with a sort of inchoate idea that I want to, you know, I owe this place something and I want to contribute to the reconstruction and development of the country. But it's easier said than done. You know, it's how do you actually go about doing that? So I took over the farm. Literally, I'm sorry to use this phrase, but it's the correct one. It comes with people. You know, they're people who live on my land. And so I felt very uneasy becoming this, you know, it's sort of feudal still, this setup there. So I met with the people who live on the farm discussed with them how we might change things. And one thing led to another. It was very hard. They were too scared to speak to me about what they really thought, if they even had articulated thoughts about how we might transform the farm, because this is just not the sort of thing that they ever expected would happen. So we brought archaeologists and historians in and literally dug the place up so that we could together see how, you know, how did it happen that we're living in the way that we are, that we don't trust each other, don't feel safe with each other, can't be on the same side. And so that led to these kind of very obvious diagnoses. It's all about who owns the land. They're poor compared to me because of that history. How do you put that right? Well, you know, you've got to do something like give the land back. And then you face the limits of your own ethical goodness, you know, because it's not so easy to give. I wanted to pass this farm on to my children as it was to me. But it's wrong, you know, how we acquired it. It's basically criminal what happened all those generations ago. So we came up with a solution of buying the farm next door, borrowing money, mortgaging my farm, and a friend of mine, a neighbor, we mortgaged our farms so that we could buy a third farm, so that the workers could own a piece of land every bit as big and beautiful and historic as our own. And then we formed a partnership. But I have to tell you, I'm sorry I'm speaking so much, but I have to tell you, it's not been plain sailing.
No.
the story of South Africa, wonderful as it is in terms of the miraculous transition that came in the 90s, that story is not yet, hasn't yet led to the happy ending that we were all idealistically and optimistically expecting. We're still working at it. It's difficult.
Would you say that these good intentions and indeed good actions have led to a better wine?
I do think so. I'm not advertising my wine when I say so, because you know you can't even get it here in Britain. So I truly am not advertising it. I'm saying something of more general importance. I think that, well, wine is a handmade product, and it's not made by me, the owner. It's made by the workers in the vineyards and the workers in the cellar. And there's an enormous amount of care that goes into the picking of the grapes and the sorting of the grapes and the tending of the wine in the barrels as it matures and so on. And if that's done with resentment and bitterness and, you know, and more, it's going to obviously affect what's in the bottle. If it's made with a sense of pride and ownership and, you know, and that this is a good thing that we're doing. You know, it's like a chef in the kitchen. You make something with love and care. It tastes different than if you just, you know, bang it all together with a minimum of effort.
You've given a fascinating TED talk about all this, which I very much recommend. But more music now. Beethoven next, and his Tempest Sonata.
What led me to this is the fact that it's a dramatic, emotional work, and we are talking. So that's the red thread through the entire selection. You know, as we listen. Well, first of all, it starts on this sort of strangely unstable note, and then there's this sort of a sense of calm and then perturbation and then calm and then perturbation as we slowly build up to the sort of stormy crescendo. And, you know, as you listen, just think also like of something like a field mouse sort of scurrying about, and then it stops and it pauses and it looks and then it runs again. And, you know, that sort of sense of things are going okay. Oh, my God, it's all going wrong. Oh, it's okay. That's the feeling for me of what we're going to listen to.
Thank you.
Angela Hewitt with the first movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 17 in D minor, The Tempest. Do you feel you've taken a little journey there, like a scurrying mouse or a much more larger beast in trouble?
My picture of Beethoven is this grumpy, it's all going wrong and you're all bad kind of attitude. But the feeling that I, ultimately, this is an extremely compassionate piece of music. I feel loved by Beethoven. I don't know if he was as grumpy as he looks, but when you listen to this, it's hard to believe.
I couldn't help thinking about what you were saying before the music, Mark, about making wine, that you can't make good wine if the workers feel resentment, hatred. And I wonder if that applies to a certain extent to all creative work. Does it apply to scientific research, for instance?
I think that the pursuit of truth, and that's an easy phrase, but you know, I assume that most of us know what it really refers to. What we're all aspiring to, and in my own research, you know, what I've been trying to understand about what is it to exist? Why are we aware of our own existence at all? What is that awareness for? What does it mean? How does it work? You know, to the pursuit of these sorts of questions, it is, if not a loving thing, it's certainly not an anger. I can't imagine how could you do it in a state of anger, you know, and destructiveness. It's trying to build something. It's trying to understand. And science and music and medicine, you know, and when I say music, I suppose all the arts, and I would include wine production. And wine is a sort of art form for the palate. You know, we're all in it together, and we're all trying to get to the bottom of it. And things go wrong. Things go horribly wrong. And that's what those negative feelings are for. But I think that these sorts of pursuits go in the other direction. It's the corrective. It's a reparative, trying to make things all right.
Well, we're going to end with what you describe as your wild card, Talking Heads and a Song About Heaven, where nothing happens. Can you imagine being happy in a place where nothing happens?
So this last song is I chose it as a bit of a joke, but also a serious one. The allusion to heaven being a place where nothing ever happens is, of course, you know, my worst fear about what happens after you die, nothing. But it also it refers to the fact that the ideal state of the body is where nothing unexpected happens. Paradoxically, that is the basic, this homeostatic principle is that we're trying to stay within our viable expected bounds of blood gases, body temperature, and so on. Deviations from that are a bad thing, biologically speaking. And so this song also picks up on that theme. Heaven is a place where nothing ever happens.
Well, let's play out on heaven and a place where, to quote the lyrics, when this kiss is over, it'll start again.
And then it says, it will not be any different. It'll be exactly the same. I'm not sure that's a good thing.
Mark Soms, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Of the world. Heaven from the 1979 album Fear of Music by Talking Heads. Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions was Mark Soms. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And the programme returns next Sunday at midday. Michael's guest will be the politician Rory Stewart. This is BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Chris Barrow. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, says MPs may be offered police protection at constituency surgeries following the killing of Sir David Amos. She said she was looking at a number of measures as part of a security review. She added that more needed to be done to tackle radicalisation on social media amid reports Sir David's attacker may have been groomed online. Police have been given until next Friday to continue questioning the man arrested on suspicion of the murder of Sir David. Ali Harbi Ali, who's 25, was arrested after the politician was stabbed repeatedly on Friday as he held a regular meeting for constituents at Leon C. The South Eastern Rail Network, connecting Kent and some of East Sussex with London, has been taken over by the government. The move was announced last month after South Eastern failed to declare £25 million of taxpayer funding. The Russian ambassador in London has denied that Russia has been withholding gas supplies for political gain. Andrei Kielin said the Kremlin had increased the flow of gas by up to 15% to Europe and that its state-controlled energy company Gazprom could do no more. Security officials in Haiti say a group of Christian missionaries and their families has been kidnapped by an armed gang near the capital Port-au-Prince. At least 15 women, men and children, mainly Americans, were abducted from a bus shortly after leaving an orphanage. Voters in Rome are choosing who will succeed Virginia Raggi as mayor to sort out disputes over coronavirus restrictions and delayed refuse collections. The rubbish crisis is so serious it's attracting wild boars. More than 60 other towns and cities are also going to the polls over 2 days. And the Grand Mosque in the Muslim holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia has begun operating at full capacity again. Let's look at cricket. The men's T20 World Cup has begun, with newcomers Papua New Guinea taking on the co-hosts Oman. 16 teams are preparing in the tournament, which is also being held in the United Arab Emirates. It was initially meant to be held in India, but was delayed because of the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the weather, a dull and damp day for most, with widespread areas of cloud and some patchy light rain and drizzle in places. The south will see some warm sunshine. However, it will be a mild evening in most areas. Highs of 15 in London, 17 in Cardiff, 15 in Belfast and 12 in Edinburgh. And that's the BBC News and weather at 2 minutes past one.
One of our most neglected symphonists.
It's music that speaks to the heart.
It's too profound, it's too deep.
In Malcolm Arnold's centenary year, Simon Heffer unearths his troubled world.
It's now widely known that he suffered greatly throughout his life from problems with his mental health.
He would disappear for days, he would be on benders. I don't know how he wrote a symphony then. I mean, he was in such a bad state.
He was a victim of his illness, and our